KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Producer Jerry Bruckheimer has had credits on some of the biggest hit movies and TV shows of the past few decades. Flashdance, Beverly Hills Cop, Pirates of the Caribbean, the list goes on. If there's one thing he's learned, it's that the business is unpredictable. Even he couldn't have guessed that Top Gun Maverick would not only be a breakout hit, but would bring him his first Oscar nomination for Best Picture.
We knew we made a very entertaining, really good movie. We had previews, and the previews went very well, but they weren't through the roof. Things change. Previews can be deceiving. There's a lot of Hollywood stories about previews that went through the roof and the studio tried to buy out the talent and the movie tanked. You just don't know.
Bruckheimer talks about his days co-producing hit after hit with the late Don Simpson, how Tom Cruise saved Top Gun Maverick from premiering on Paramount Plus, and how the military actually didn't jump at the chance to make the first Top Gun. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my sidekick in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, as you know, James Gunn, the filmmaker, and his partner, Peter Safran, revealed to the world their plan for DC, the unit they oversee at Warner Brothers Discovery, DC being Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, all these big properties that Warner's for years has done various iterations of, has never quite in the movies managed to match Marvel and has really, really wanted to. And along came the gun, and I will say in very colorful language, some of which we can't repeat on public radio, talking about this new plan and kind of dumping on the previous plans.
Yeah, we will omit the F words, but he really took aim at the previous management of DC and the fact that there was the Arrowverse on CW and there was the Snyderverse in the movie theaters. And then there was, you know, the animated stuff, and it was all kind of different. And he said, that's all over. We're having one unified story throughout the DC universe. And that's all great to say. But the problem is that the exploitation of the DC properties was very lucrative for Warner Brothers. And they really benefited from having these different programs in different areas and the movies that would generate money from box office. And it wasn't like this was an unprofitable venture. It just wasn't Marvel. And now they are dropping all of that and they're just mimicking Marvel. It's funny, they are calling it the chapter one of their universe, not phase one like Marvel uses. It's chapter one. So they're trying to, you know, be a little bit different at least, but it's really just mimicking Marvel. And he's coming out guns blazing. It's just when you do that, now you've got to deliver. And they really haven't delivered yet.
And I haven't had a chance. And I will note, as we've talked about before, there are people who are in love with previous versions of this. You know, there's a whole big group of Snyderverse fans who love Zack Snyder's vision and are already gunning, excuse the expression, for James Gunn on Twitter. You know, fire James Gunn is already a thing. Not that I would expect that to have any impact at all. I know there are a lot of people in the Warner Brothers Discovery world who probably wish that James Gunn would stop doing this kind of thing. You know, he's been tweeting, he's been talking, but I guess he's going to be what he is. And as you say, we have to hope that it works out for the parent company.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that he's being very specific in criticisms, like this whole Henry Cavill thing where he's claiming that, you know, the previous regime dicked around Henry Cavill. It's weird that he said that because the current heads of Warner Brothers, Pam Abdy and Mike DeLuca, they're the ones that let The Rock put Henry Cavill into Black Adam, and they specifically overruled Walter Hamada, who had said no, that he wasn't going to be in that movie. So he's kind of weirdly criticizing the current leadership of Warner Brothers while ascribing it to the past leadership.
Yeah, I don't want to overread, but we know the current leadership of Warner Brothers wouldn't have minded being in charge of the DC universe. So maybe there was a little conscious or unconscious shot at that. And the other thing I will note that I think is kind of funny is they can't get away from the whole deal. They can't kill off all the other previous things. You have Todd Phillips in the process, I think, of making his sequel to Joker. James Gunn can't jump on that, nor can he jump on the Matt Reeves Batman movie, his second one following The Batman. So they're calling that Elseworld. I think that's kind of a funny thing to do, to just explain why they don't have control over absolutely everything.
Yeah, that is funny. And they've also got this Flash movie that is coming out later this year that, you know, has been kind of mired in controversy over Ezra Miller. But they made a point of saying it's the best DC movie that they've ever released, and it's so great, it's a reset. But how much does it comport with what their vision is for DC in the future? And will these actors still keep portraying these characters beyond this one movie? We don't know that yet, because we haven't seen who's going to be cast in all these future DC movies. It's just funny that they have to deal with these movies that are coming out this year and next. So the Aquaman sequel as well.
Yeah, finished. Therefore, it all fits. I think that's the answer. Now, let's just briefly talk about Showtime and Paramount Plus. Paramount, the parent company, has created, and this is not a shock, this sort of blending of Showtime and Paramount Plus, the streamer. They have given it the rolls right off the tongue name, Paramount Plus with Showtime.
Yeah, it's right up there with FX on Hulu.
Yes. So if you are subscribing to Paramount Plus, I guess you are now subscribing to Paramount Plus with Showtime. But if you have Showtime as part of your cable bundle, you have also got Paramount Plus with Showtime. That's a different version. I can't figure it out.
Yeah, it's a little complicated because Showtime was hampered by these agreements with the cable companies that carry Showtime. They obviously didn't want Showtime to go away, and they have subscribers to that channel. So what they're doing essentially is they're saying Showtime Linear will exist, but it's going to be Paramount Plus with Showtime, and some of the Paramount Plus programming will also air on the linear channel. But the focus, for the most part, and this is why most people have been interpreting this as the next phase in the slow demise of Showtime, is that the focus for the premium content is going to be on Paramount Plus. That is what the company cares about. That is where they're going to put all their resources. And I think we're going to see significant layoffs and significant lack of ambition in the Showtime content.
Well, I'm glad you are here to explain some of this, Matt. I mean, eventually, yes, Showtime will go away over time. But at this moment, it's a confusing world, not only in terms of what each company is offering, but which ones you want to subscribe to and where it's going to go. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. With almost 50 years of experience in the business, Jerry Bruckheimer has credits on a whole bunch of highly profitable franchises, with titles like Bad Boys, Pirates of the Caribbean, and most recently, Top Gun Maverick. Not to mention TV series like CSI and The Amazing Race. The long gestating Top Gun sequel has grossed almost $1.5 billion in global box office. But the road to making the movie was hardly smooth. In 2012, the production took a staggering blow when Tony Scott, who directed the original movie, died by suicide just days into location scouting for the sequel. It wasn't until 2017 that Bruckheimer tapped Tom Cruise's Oblivion director, Joseph Kosinski, for the project. The movie was shot, and then the pandemic hit. With theaters closed for the better part of 2 years, the film's release was delayed repeatedly. It finally premiered in May of 2022, and it was the number one movie in the country on Memorial Day and on Labor Day. In Top Gun Maverick, Tom Cruise is tasked with training a new generation of pilots. Of course, he does it in typical Maverick fashion.
Good morning, aviators. This is your captain speaking. Welcome to Basic Fighter Maneuvers.
As briefed, today's exercise is dogfighting. Guns only, no missiles. We do not go below the hard deck of 5,000 feet. Working as a team, you have to shoot me down or else.
Or else what, sir?
Or else I shoot back.
If I shoot either one of you down, you both lose.
Jerry Bruckheimer's career took off in the early 1980s when he partnered with the brilliant but troubled Don Simpson. The two teamed up on movies including Flashdance, Beverly Hills Cop, Bad Boys, and of course, Top Gun. Let's take a little bit of a stroll down memory lane. And sure. I mean, we've known each other for really a long time. When I met you, you were partners with the late Don Simpson.
That's true.
And you shared a desk, and your office is in Paramount. Famous shared desk. I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. You know, I know you obviously worked closely and found a lot of success with Don, as we know now, since it doesn't matter anymore. You know, Don was a really important source for me. He was like my professor of Hollywoodology. Just give me a little sense of how that partnership worked and how it stopped working, if you can.
Well, he was always the inside guy, and because he was head of production at Paramount, so he understood how the studios worked. He would always give me a dissertation after a meeting with an executive, what the meeting really meant and didn't mean what they were saying. It's something totally different. We'll get a call from the lawyers, you know, within a day or so and change everything that we talked about in that meeting. So he was brilliant at reading meetings and reading people and storytelling. His skill was always in working on scripts and coming up with ideas. He worked on it day and night and weekends. He had an idea book where he had tons of ideas and movies he wanted to make. And I was the guy who made movies. So I was always the one who knew how to actually physically produce a movie and find the best talent for it, where he was the story guy and a character and did all kinds of things that you need to make a very successful movie based on a terrific script.
Yes. And of course, as we both know, he had major demons. He was brilliant, but troubled and tortured. And I would say even more so your experience than mine. I sort of had a whole life with Don on the phone, mostly with these long conversations, you know, telling me what the meeting really meant and what the exactly. executive was really saying. You know, you did that for me. And you split up, actually. It became too much for you, as I recall, before he finally succumbed to all of that.
Yes. That's correct. No, I said, look, you got to get your life turned around. And I think the best way, you just got to do it. And it's better for me to separate from you so you can do that. As long as I'm kind of a crutch and being here running everything, you got to deal with the issues you have. And unfortunately, he passed away shortly after that.
Yeah, actually, I was supposed to be interviewing him for Vanity Fair about his post-breakup plans. But I was supposed to fly to LA the day he died. So I never had that conversation with him, on the record at least. Many people sort of thought, oh, Don is the flamboyant, brilliant bad boy. And then Jerry's does whatever he does. And you've gone on to have just a stunning success. And I don't even know if you've ever tallied up the grosses of all your movies. I think we did it once, and it's certainly in the billions. But what were people getting wrong there when they gave so much credit to Don?
Well, he was a flamboyant, brilliant character. And he was the one who could take over a meeting in a room, a party. And he was very verbal. And I'm kind of quiet and shy and don't have that skill that he had. That's why it was such a great partnership. He could captivate a room. He could sell anybody on anything. And you know, he was brilliant at it. I just went out and just put my nose to the grindstone and did the work.
But you're creating franchises. You know, people didn't have a notion of Pirates of the Caribbean as movies until, and it's actually, as you, I know, recall, people thought it was kind of a stupid idea to do it at the time because it was based on theme park attractions at Disney. You know, they were making several, didn't seem like that was going to be the most successful idea. And then you come along with Pirates.
Well, they'd done two other ride movies and both of them failed. Haunted Mansion, and I think there was one other.
Eminently forgettable. I think we both can't remember.
So the talent you put into it, when you take Johnny Depp and you take him from a place where he's a real artist, and he is a real artist and a brilliant actor, but he doesn't make really commercial choices. He makes very art-centric movies, which are excellent, plays really interesting characters, and you put him in a very commercial movie, it sends a signal to the audience, oh, wait a second. This has to be different. It can't be just a theme park ride. You got Johnny Depp in it. I got to check this out. And then you hire two writers who had worked on some wonderful things in the past and had a brilliant idea on how to do this, how you take the pirate genre and add the supernatural and make it something really interesting. And they kind of gleaned off the ride and took a lot of the things from the ride and incorporated it into the screenplay. But they had a wonderful wit. And then you find a director like Gore Verbinski who has got the sense of humor and a sense of action and cinematically brilliant. And you put him at the helm of it and you created something really special. All three of them did. It's just how you put the team together That's what a producer should be doing. He's kind of like a general manager of a team. He doesn't own the team, but he's got to put all the pieces in place that will make the team run and win. And Pirates was a great example of a team that was put together and it won.
Yeah, big, in a big way. It was such a fun movie, a set of movies, I should say. So Top Gun. I mean, I feel like I'm touching on all these difficult situations and losses, but the thought of doing another Top Gun was originally completely disrupted when Tony Scott committed suicide. You had been planning to do it before that happened. Is that right?
Correct. In fact, we were on a scout on a Friday in Fallon, Nevada, where the Top Gun school is now, with Tom, and I think a writer was with us, I'm not sure, to try to figure out the story, and interviewed a lot of Top Gun pilots. And unfortunately, Tony left us on Sunday. So it was really a shock to all of us.
Yes, that was a shock to the entire community here and beyond. And did it just feel like we can't do this right now? Or
Absolutely. I mean, it slowed everything down. There was still a part of all of us that wanted to get another one made. Tom, of course, was the one who felt that it had to be perfect to get this made, because it's a seminal character that kind of rocketed him into superstardom and made him a star around the world. So he wanted it. If you're going to do it, you better do it as good, if not better than the first one. And Joe Kaczynski came in sometime later and had an idea that we liked. And I flew to Paris with Joe while Tom was filming another Mission Impossible, and sat down with him and pitched him the story of the movie that you saw. And he said, I love it, but Joe, you got to promise me one thing, that we shoot all the aerial stuff for real and the actors are actually in these planes. On the first movie, we put them in the planes and they all threw up. We couldn't use any of the footage. We got a little footage on Tom because he can do just about anything on the first one. But so we devised a plan, basically he did, on how he's going to train these actors in various different aircraft over a 3-4 month period to withstand the G-forces that they need to sit in an F-18 and be able to act. But in reality, they weren't acting. That was all real. And it was facial expressions. They were feeling those G-forces. They went through a lot to get this movie made in a way that an audience certainly has embraced it, because it's real and it feels real because it is.
This movie was finished, I guess, before the pandemic, and then was just held.
That's true. Tom was adamant that the picture had to be released in theaters, and we held it. I think we had 3 separate release dates, and the country wasn't really ready, or the world wasn't ready. We were still in lockdown. And so we held it for 2 years and finally brought it out. So we're very fortunate. It's a movie that brought an older audience back to the theaters and showed them that you can really be entertained and make you feel better and walk out feeling better than you walked in and forget about all your problems and all the things. It kind of did the same thing around the world. Our foreign grosses were bigger than our domestic grosses. So you can just see it wasn't just a quote, an American movie. It was a movie that entertained people everywhere from all ages. And the reason that it became the big success is not all the action and all the things that we know how to do really well in Hollywood. It was really the emotion between these characters, bringing Val Kilmer back and him creating that character, using what is part of his own problem and making it part of the movie, which I thought was very bold and interesting that he did that. And Tom embracing him. Tom said, I'm not going to make this movie without Val being in it. Tom is a friend for life. When you befriend Tom, he will bend over backwards and do anything for you. He's really a terrific individual.
Coming up after the break, Jerry Bruckheimer talks about how Tom Cruise shot down Paramount's notion of premiering Top Gun Maverick on the company's nascent streaming service. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Jerry Bruckheimer has produced some of the biggest franchise series in recent decades. Bad Boys, Pirates of the Caribbean, National Treasure, and most recently, Top Gun Maverick, which hit nearly $1.5 billion at the box office. In Top Gun Maverick, a group of students in the Top Gun school is tasked with a covert operation requiring near impossible piloting feats. As training for this mission proves too difficult for the class, Tom Cruise's Maverick defies orders from Vice Admiral Bo Simpson, played by John Hamm, and shows everyone how it's done.
Maverick to range control. Entering Point Alpha. Confirm green range.
Maverick, range control. Green range is confirmed. I don't see an event scheduled for you, sir.
Well, I'm going anyway.
Nice. I've written and talked about Tom's controversies, but I won't trouble you with those. Let's talk about the Tom who, when shooting Mission Impossible 7 during the pandemic, was consciously saying, we are going to save the movie business here. I don't think there's any star more dedicated to his own stardom and the fans than Tom Cruise, and who has the power to say to anybody, but most of all Paramount, you know, that you will not put this movie on a streamer. you will not shorten my theatrical window. And as you know, Jerry, many attempts were made by the studio, and you can understand why they're trying to launch Paramount Plus and trying to move into the future. And it just was never going to happen.
Well, first of all, he's somebody who's really dedicated to an audience and to the craft of filmmaking and the theatrical experience. And the movie was made for theaters. It's made to be a group experience. So he had to make sure that that's how it was released. And let's face it, he's making two Mission Impossibles for them, which are big summer releases. And he's a star that carries an enormous amount of weight because he brings people to the theaters and makes some money. In retrospect, the picture's done almost $1.5 billion. So it worked out well for Paramount and worked out well for the theatrical business too. It made people feel safe to go out again.
You've long worked with the Defense Department on this movie as well. I think somebody wrote that you paid something like $11,000 and change per hour for the Super Hornets and pilots to fly them.
We paid for the gas. Look, the pilots love to be in the air. They love to fly. They got extra hours working on the movie. The Navy was enormously cooperative, unlike the first one when we proposed it to them. They only saw the downside. The admiral at the base said, I don't think this is good for us. It only could hurt my career if something goes wrong. Tom and I flew to Washington and met with John Layman, who at the time was the Secretary of the Navy. And we pitched him the movie. And he said, this, I think, will be good for us. And that admiral was replaced. And we made the movie. And reluctantly for some of the people in the Navy who had the responsibility of those pilots and planes. But the second time around, it was open arms. Their recruitment went up 500% after the movie came out.
So I read somebody asked you, you know, the state of the movie business today, which you're still killing it. But I think one thing you said you heard the most from studios is that they always want the movie to be shorter. Is that right?
I don't think I've ever made a movie that was too short. They're always too long and we always have to cut them back. But that's just the nature. They're all too expensive and they're all too long. That's just how Hollywood works. So we kind of work within their parameters. And sometimes that takes a little longer than an hour, hour and a half. A lot of the films that are sometimes 3 hours are very captivating and you want to keep on that ride. You don't want it to end. It's like a good book. Could be 500 pages, but you don't want it to end.
Right. Well, so now we find with your too long, too expensive, another one of your too long, too expensive movies that you are nominated, I think the first time, right?
It is. It is. Finally, I got around to getting a nomination. I've been doing this almost 50 years and made over 50 movies. And it's a real honor to be accepted, not only accepted, but something that your peers think you did a really good job. So that's really nice. You make movies with them and you make movies for them. And it's so nice when they kind of congratulate you on something we worked very hard on.
not all of your movies are swashbuckling or adventure or thriller, whatever. You've done more serious movies than, when I say serious, more like adult drama type of movies in the past. And yet this is the one I can't imagine you would have anticipated. I always heard the movie was good. The movie was good while it was being held. People at Paramount would tell me the movie's really good. The movie's really good. But did you imagine that this would be the one?
You never know. I never know if they're going to be a hit. Anybody who tells you they just made a hit movie before it comes out, they're lying to you because they don't know. Nobody knows. We knew we made a very entertaining, really good movie, but you never know how an audience is going to accept it. We had previews and the previews went very well, but they weren't through the roof like some other pictures I've worked on where you have really high scores. It was a very high score, but it was something that, you know, a younger audience didn't quite embrace initially. Mm-hmm. But then when it came out, it was everybody. Kids saw it 4 or 5 times. So things change. Previews can be deceiving. There's a lot of Hollywood stories about previews that went through the roof and the studio tried to buy out the talent and the movie tanked. You just don't know.
So, I mean, you didn't know it would be a hit, but I would also imagine you didn't know it would be your Oscar nomination either.
No, of course not. You never predict that. I've made some pictures that I think should have been. I think Black Hawk Down, I think Ridley might have gotten nominated. I'm not sure. And I think Johnny might have, I don't know, some Pirates might have gotten some nominations. We've won Academy Awards for music and other things. You never know. We just finished another one with Daisy Ridley called Young Woman in the Sea, about the first woman to ever swim the English Channel back in 1926. It's for Disney Plus, and it's something that was the highest scoring movie we've ever made. But again, we all know that that doesn't mean much, but it's certainly the audience that saw it really loved it.
So you're venturing into the streaming world with Disney Plus.
Yeah, we look at it. It's a passion project. It's something that we tried to get made for over 7 years. Jeff Nathanson, who has 2 young daughters, he was looking at the time, he was looking for something that he could watch with them and couldn't find anything. And he read this book about this young woman named Trudy Eberle. And it was such an inspirational story. He optioned the book himself and came to us and said, I'd like to write this. Let's see if we can get it made. So we took it everywhere. We had it at Warner's for a while. And then Disney Plus, Sean Bailey and Sam Dickerman really championed the project and we got it made there. And, you know, Jeff is thrilled. It turned out fantastic.
I was wondering when you mentioned it, like I was going to say, how do you get any studio to make that for theatrical? And the answer is you don't at this point, right? I mean, I imagine for someone with your broad interests in a lot of things, maybe it's a bit frustrating that it seems like the studios are so caught up in horror and tentpole comic book movies at this point.
Well, we're still hoping we can get a theatrical release on this movie because it's so strong. And it certainly is something that should be seen in the theater because it's such an emotional story. But it turned out just terrific. I'm very excited by it.
I wonder if you will. I'm not surprised. And we have seen some studios, including Paramount, and I think another one recently, take a movie. Paramount took Smile that was supposed to be released online and in Paramount Plus and put it in theaters. And it did very well. So there's hope that maybe when they see the movie, you will manage to get it in theaters after all. Is Hollywood harder now because you've been in it for a long time? And I don't know, it was always hard. Is it harder now?
Well, I think you said it perfectly. Unless it's a genre picture or something that was pre-sold or a sequel, they're hard to get made unless you commit a number of stars to it and then you have a better shot of getting it made. But the streamers will pay a lot of money for that also. It's good for talent because there's so many venues that you can get a movie made with. I mean, whether it's a streamer or a theatrical, but if you remember when you and I started, there were 6, 7 studios and that was it.
Yeah.
Now with all the streamers and studios now, you have a lot of places to place your material and get it made and also seen by the public.
So have you picked out your Oscar outfit yet, Jerry?
It was a big shock. I mean, I certainly have a tux, so, you know.
That's the advantage men have over women. You need the tux. We have to change it all the time. So not fair, right?
It certainly isn't. My wife tells me that all the time.
I'm sure she does. I feel that. Jerry Bruckheimer produced Top Gun Maverick and many other films. Top Gun Maverick is now streaming on Paramount Plus after an ample theatrical run. Thank you so much for doing this, Jerry.
Sure. It's a pleasure always to talk to you. And I'm thrilled that we got nominated. I'm so happy for Tom and everybody else associated with the movie, Joe Kaczynski, Chris McCrory, all the writers that now are being recognized by the Academy. It's a thrill.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Matt Schwartz, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.